by going around the table, and I'll ask each of you to just run through, or without saying too much about each movie, what your lists are. And Desmond Ryan, why don't we start with you?
Very well. I would start certainly with The Empire. These are in no particular order of preference. The Empire Strikes Back, the sequel to Star Wars, and I think a better film than that. Kagamusha, The Elephant Man, Raging Bull, The Stuntman, Ordinary People, The Big Red One, The Black Stallion, Brubaker, and The Tin Drum. And I suppose I ought to add by way of explanation that sometimes films are released at the end of a year to qualify for the Oscars, but they do not play nationally, and that would explain why The Black Stallion and The Tin Drum are on this year's list.
Do you want to do your 10 worst?
With pleasure. So out of a heady field of competition, I picked Cruising, Caligula, Windows, The Jazz Singer, The Blues Brothers, Cheech and Chong's next movie, and I hope their last, Caddyshack, Raise the Titanic, The Island, and The Gong Show movie.
Oh, there's some movies there that I didn't get a chance to see. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some of those. Ernie Scheer, what was your 10 best, 10 worst list?
Well, I think there's some interaction or overlap here between Desmond and myself. So I picked a couple of Desmond's best on my worst list, and that's, I think, how criticism falls sometimes. My 10 best were All That Jazz. I debated about that one being there. Best Boy, the documentary, Ordinary People, which was Robert Redford's first directing, Stardust Memories, Woody Allen's film, The Elephant Man, The Great Santini, Raging Bull, The Stuntman, and The Tin Drum. My 10 worst, you get kind of boxed in there or straitjacketed, because I felt that they could have put 30 films on there. Cruising, Chapter 2, Nijinsky, Caligula, Happy Birthday Gemini, which purported to be a film about South Philadelphia, The Shining, Rough Cut, Brubaker, The Blue Lagoon, and A Change of Seasons.
Okay, Bill Van Wert, Fresh Air's film reviewer. What was your 10 best list for 1980?
Well, I did this just for this program. I've not ever done a 10 best or 10 worst before. Two films I'd like to mention that are not getting much talk at all that came early in the year and are on my list are The Long Riders, the Western, and Wise Blood, John Huston's film from Flannery O'Connor. I just really like those two films, and I don't think they're going to go anywhere in terms of getting support. Airplane, The Stuntman, and I would, if I could have All That Jazz on the list, I would. I think The Stuntman is this year's All That Jazz for me. It's the most exciting film of the list. The Tin Drum, I think, was the best foreign film. That or Godard's Every Man for Himself, which is also on my list. The Shining, Kubrick's film. One Trick Pony, which I don't think anyone is picking up much on. Maybe we can talk about that later. Paul Simon's film. Stardust Memories, The Great Santini, Coal Miner's Daughter, The Big Red One. And I've not seen Raging Bull yet, so I can't put it on the list. And I think there are some that I haven't seen. I don't know if these men have seen them that just haven't come to Philadelphia, like Altered States or René's film Mon Oncle d'Amérique, Polanski's Tess, Melvin and Howard, and so on, that are making people's lists nationally. But, you know, I just don't have the opportunity to mention them, not having seen them.
Have you done a 10 worst list?
I did. People who've listened to me should know that Motel Hell would be first on the list. It's the only one of its kind I saw this year, and that's number one. I especially didn't like also The Blues Brothers, Private Benjamin, A Small Circle of Friends, Urban Cowboy, Blue Lagoon, The Hunter, Willie and Phil, Middle Age Crazy, and The Empire Strikes Back. And for most of those that are well-known, like Empire Strikes Back, Middle Age Crazy, Willie and Phil, and A Small Circle of Friends, I didn't like them because they had promise, and I thought they betrayed it. I thought that they really ended up being insidious that way.
Okay, well, I'd like to go around the table again and give each of you the opportunity to react to the other two 10 best lists. Desmond, right?
Well, I suppose it proves what a preposterous parlor game the whole business is. I mean, you asked earlier whether one liked or disliked doing this. I do it because it's expected, and people seem to enjoy it, and they like to write to you and curse you and call you up. But what does best mean? It is by definition superlative, that something is better than something else. And to say that Kagemusha, whose intentions are incredibly noble and in every way different from a film, say, like Escape from Alcatraz, since the intentions of the two people who made these two ventures are so totally diverse, how can you say that one was better in a sort of absolute sense than the other? And that's what we're talking about here, absolutes. So I always preface these things by saying that it's fun to do it, but it really doesn't mean that much.
Well, nevertheless, I think there's some conflicting opinions on certain films, so I wonder if you'd like to...
Sure, I'll defend... Yeah. What shall I pick to defend? Brubaker. Ernie didn't like Brubaker, I understand. I thought for... Even with, if you allowed its weaknesses, that this was a remorseless, intense, and very well-done prison drama. It tended to get into its sermons at some points. Its screenplay was weak at some points. But within the prison, I think it's one of the best American prison films ever made.
Why did you put it on your 10 worst list?
Well, for one thing, I thought Stuart Rosenberg had already did it without a prison reformer in the... the Paul Newman film,
Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, and I thought that Redford's mind was someplace else.
I disagree entirely. I thought that was one of the best things he's done as an actor. It seems to be his year in a lot of ways. He's made his debut as a director and a very auspicious one.
It's interesting to me, but I thought it was an example of. Kind of knee-jerk social reform film without really the dramatic tensions that need to go with that kind of film.
Bill, I think it made neither of your lists, if I'm not mistaken.
No.
What did you think of the film?
Well, when I did review it, I remember that I broke it into intentions as being good and splitting it into two halves. That as long as he was undercover, you got some pretty tough filmmaking, and as soon as he became a crusader, it was everyone's Hollywood script, that it did not hold its intensity, nor did it show any new grasp of prison reform. It, you know, it was Redford in close-ups and Redford and the loner, etc. It didn't have any example to it. I think what's interesting about these lists, picking up on what Desmond said, for me, when I read them, rather than as critic, is to find out what made the list, but also have there be a long explanation with it. Because I think what's interesting about them is the point of view of the critic, not that we're all different or we disagree. And it's the challenge for me is it's a chance to very succinctly have to defend what you like most about film, show the varieties you go for, etc. I liked, for example, The Stuntman a lot because it seemed to me a very entertaining film for most people out there to get on a surface level. You got a lot from first viewing. It's also a meta film, and for someone like me who takes lots of notes in films and so on, it had a lot to say about illusion, about accidents and so on, and... You know, I like a film that does that, and that's why I called it this year's All That Jazz. I think when Desmond mentioned Kagemusha, it's not just the intentions, but if we've seen other Kurosawa films, I did not put it on the list because I didn't think it was good Kurosawa. By the same token, I put, something like Willie and Phil down on the worst list because I know Mazursky can do better. So... I think that prejudice comes into play. I put Every Man for Himself on the list. I don't think it's very good Godard, but it's very provocative still. And it's, I think that sometimes we're comparing in our own minds what the director has done before, how it stacks up with its competition, etc.
Ernie Shearer, would you like to react to Bill's or Desmond's choices?
Both to Bill and Desmond, I have felt over the last decade, pretty much until this year, the way the way Desmond has felt that it was kind of a game. I think last year, not for 79, I had a 9-best list because
it's hard finding 10 in that year, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, just to say, well, you don't have to do 10, you can do 9, 8, 7, 14 maybe if you want to. I remember one year I did 9.5 because it was the it was a couple of decades ago, I guess, and they had revived Modern Times, which was, you know, just about better than anything that was currently in. But it struck me this year as I sat down to write that obligatory column that there is maybe a responsibility that goes with it of sorting the honest superior efforts from the trash. And I firmly believe that we're in an age of garbage as far as films go, and it becomes therefore more important to sift through and hold up the best works, regardless of their popularity or lack thereof, in order to somehow, for myself, maintain a balance of standard, a balance of excellence, when we're being buried by all this perishable debris that keeps falling on us. So I think now, in the current time, I'm sort of back into 10 best for that reason of trying to help establish, at least for myself, if for nobody else, the concept of excellence. By the same token, I think a 10 worst list, I automatically eliminate from that. I didn't feel very funny when I was writing the 10 worst films. That's supposed to be, lots of laughs because we're throwing darts, and I sat down to write it, and I said, now, you know, you've got to be up for it and see if you can't, you know, be really nifty and clever. And the more I got into it, the more depressed I got about it. And my sense of that was that I have never, in describing a 10 worst list, picked on little targets. I mean, there are lots of people who come along and make absolutely terrible films. It really doesn't matter. I have some thoughts about that, about the relevance of a certain amount of reviewing, but I wanted to talk about the worst films made by people who had a previous track record, who were established as either directors, producers, stars, and writers, and who either knew better or the thing had gotten out of hand. In other words, I feel if you do a 10 worst list, that the objects and targets, if you will, have got to be worthy of making that list.
Ernie, you just referred to this year as a year in the age of garbage. And I think as long as I've been reading 10 best lists every year, someone has said that about that year's crops of movies. But it seems to me that somehow 20 years afterwards, a lot of what was considered to be garbage the year it came out is reassessed as being a wonderful piece of popular art. And I'm thinking of a lot of genre films, detective films, musicals, westerns. Would you agree, Desmond, that this has been a year of garbage? How does it rate up compared to other years that you've been reviewing?
I think one of the worst, I felt particularly during the summer that Earl Stout ought to be reviewing the film instead of me, that there was, at the height of the summer, a flush of toilet comedies, which rained at teenagers. And I'm quite sure that the parents don't realize what's being foisted on these kids. I refer to Caddyshack, Up the Academy, Gorp, Cheech and Chong, that kind of thing. And comedy seems to me to have absolutely been flattened this year, right down to the lowest common denominator, with the emphasis on lowest, where just dull, physical slapstick toilet humor has completely prevailed, and there are very, very few exceptions to that. A film I like, we haven't mentioned yet, which was aimed at young people and went quite against their grain, was My Bodyguard. I like that. But generally, that, and I think the other leading cause of garbage last year was horror films, and the fact that each director, it's become a sort of a way that young directors and young filmmakers can get a start is by making a low-budget horror film the way John Carpenter started last year. But their general thing has been to repeat the same situation of the imperiled girl in various forms, prom night, going back to Halloween. And the attitudes to women that are being fostered by films like this are not a matter to be sort of dismissed in one, you know, light line. They're very serious, I think.
Bill, did this seem to you to be a really trashy year for films?
Well, I think there was a drought in the summer, as you mentioned, and we did about 3 or 4 weeks of enforced Caddyshack Guild Alive. Anyone who was on Laugh-In or Saturday Night Live and made a movie, we had to review them because that's all that was out, and I agree that they're awful and not funny, and comedy's lost its way in a lot of ways. I think it was a good year, though, in terms of invention.
You couldn't have covered all the Christmas films. I mean, where were you? I mean, what do you think of something like, for example, it's a big name movie. I put it on my 10 worst list, Change of Seasons with Shirley MacLaine and Anthony Hopkins. I mean, those are big name people, and the director Richard Lang has been around for a while, and they ought to know really what they're doing. But it's really,
you should have called that a change of life. You know, it was pretty awful.
I just think there are I don't know. I guess I want to not be too pessimistic about it. I think that when people like Coppola and Lucas can bring us the Black Stallion, Kagemusha, and Every Man for Himself in a year. You know, I think that there's been much more awareness of foreign films and the Tin Drum as well. I think that there have been new efforts like Redford's with Ordinary People, some bad new efforts like Goldie Hawn and Private Benjamin. But I think, you know, that there's been some good invention going on.
Yes, but any sort of, perceptive knowledge of the film industry would tell you that the good films that get made, such as, I think, Brubaker, and Ernie and I agree on something like Raging Bull or Ordinary People. These are films that almost get it made in spite of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
That it takes a name like Redford and his kind of clout and his kind of money to get a film like that made. And they are very much the exceptions to a real trash heap.
Well, last year, Kramer versus Kramer walked away with a lot of Academy Awards and was considered to be the runaway success of the year. And I guess the equivalent this year, and I think a number of people have mentioned this, would be Ordinary People.
Right.
Now, that showed up on your 10 best list, mm-hmm. Ernie Shearer. Was it on yours, Desmond?
Yes.
And Bill, I think, was absent from yours.
Well, I had it down, but I'd named enough. I didn't number mine. So.
Yeah. Well, Bill, you've mentioned on the show that you see the whole Kramer versus Kramer, Ordinary People type of film that's being made and becoming very popular now as saying a lot of interesting things about the way films are starting to depict relationships between families and between fathers and sons. And I'd like you to just capsulize that thought for us, and then I'd like to go around the table again and hear what your reactions to that would be.
Well, I think I discussed this first with Kramer versus Kramer and came back to it with Great Santini, Ordinary People, and One Trick Pony. And it's not new beginning with Kramer versus Kramer. I mean, things like The Champ or even Angels with Dirty Faces. There are older adult men with kids throughout film history. But what seems to have gotten started with Kramer versus Kramer was a sense of the man as a pro forma bottom out, not being able to make the relationship with the woman. The woman is actually somewhere in there a pretext, given a very fixed role, and that it's not a sense of going into therapy, it's not a sense of soul-searching with the partner, it's a given that it's a breakup. And the man's traditional protector roles, provider roles, tenderness in a buddy-buddy way, gets then transferred very easily and very obsessively to the child, the male child. And so that the real love affair going on then at the end of Ordinary People is really the son finally saying to Donald Sutherland, I like it when you get mad at me, you know? I mean, and they're kind of sitting there like husband and wife together. This is the real nuclear family.
Embracing is the film is.
Yeah. And I think I put One Trick Pony on my 10 best or however many I had because it seemed to me to give an answer to all that that the others didn't, which was a sense of Paul Simon, like many other people, you know, people in my father's generation, maybe they did want to be, if not rock stars, Tommy Dorsey stars, or the great American novelist or whatever. But they gave that up. They stayed with whatever they were doing. And I think our young people today aren't so willing to give it up for relationships. And this was a film about someone still trying to be Elvis 20 years later. And it showed some growth at the end, where he does come back and admit to some things to his wife. And the wife was not a pretext. I mean, she did get to have some feelings about sex, about childcare, and so on. And unfortunately, only for a third of the film. You know, I mean, she was absent from all of the band scenes. But it seemed to be a kind of breakthrough in that trend of, yes, men can be tender too, and they're not ogres, and they do custody as well as provide, etc. And
so to sum up, do you see those images as being reactionary or sensitive?
I see them as being very subtle anti-ERA, anti-women's lib, the way a Sammy Fuller or a Sam Peckinpah or Richard Serafian are not subtle. You know, I mean, The Wild Bunch is very much against women, and these films are also.
But in a different way.
But in a very subtle way.
Desmond, what do you think of that argument?
Well, I think one of the encouraging, it's not really a trend around enough films to say that, but one of the things that the success of Kramer versus Kramer encouraged because of its commercial success, not because of its critical success, was a climate in which it was possible to make films about personal relationships a little easier to get them on. But on top of that, it must be said that some of these films about personal relationships are absolutely atrocious. The Turning Point, because films are made and written in Hollywood, a lot of them are infected by California speak, and you can sit there for 2 hours listening to Joel Klebo talking about finding her own space like she's a real estate salesman. And this kind of thing, A Change of Seasons, I think, was infected with the same kind of incredibly mawkish, vague writing in which people, just as they are if you ever go to Los Angeles, often allege to be communicating with each other in a kind of language which just sets them apart. And when you write a film which uses that kind of language, in which somebody would say, I can relate to that, or whatever, a kind of argo and parlance that sets people aside and becomes totally imprecise, where the very best personal relationship films, such as have been made here, are ones that have been very precisely written, which have a very precise knowledge of human emotions and how people act. And I suppose it's almost superfluous to say that the French do this very well, or at least they used to. They're turning frothy lately. But the very best French films of the last 10 years, and I guess it's true of the European cinema, certainly the German, have been these small sculpted dramas that touch you very deeply because that's where you live your own life.
Ernest, I'd like to hear your reaction to Bill's
comments. I think it's a mistake to bulk all these films together. I don't think really they are the same film. I think Kramer and Kramer was pure soap opera and really, really very garbagey. I don't think Ordinary People is anti-woman. Happens to be a story about a family breaking up. What's interesting to me about Ordinary People compared to the other people is a great deal more sophisticated psychological input into that film. I think what the film says ultimately, outside the obvious thing of, you know, the family needs love. They're beginning to examine the nuclear family, and of course that varies. There are no rules about it, and everybody has their own particular perspective about it. The thing that struck me about ordinary people is that they're all victims. They were victims of each other. They were victims of the breakup of the family, and I think things were just as hard on the wife, for whom I felt, as a matter of fact, a great deal of a sympathy for her coldness, her bitchiness, her inability to, you know, love her son and her husband. And it strikes me that what these efforts are, what the good ones or the bad ones, is, maybe among some people. It's really terrible to generalize about movies because they're so individualistic, except the and they're tricky to make too, because one piece of bad casting or one scene that's written or one scene that is not written more often will strengthen or lessen the film. But I think maybe this is going to sound terribly Pollyannish, right? I think maybe even these people in California are beginning to search for or look back on traditional values, to re-examine traditional values and try to discover where things have gone wrong.
I'll drop the subject of ordinary people in a moment, but there's something I'm really curious about. Having watched an incredible flurry of critical acclaim for the movie and great box office success, I went to see the movie, and I can't tell you how bored I was by it. I felt that the movie was really scraping beneath the surface and examining all these things to tell us what probably we already knew, that people who spend a whole lot of attention worrying about place settings, and when that's the central focus of their lives, place settings and golf, that it's a superficial way to live, and one should care about the members in their family, and gosh, you always hurt the one you love.
No, I would reject that, just to say that of its many virtues.
Oh, can I just add one thing? Yeah. And that if you go to a good psychiatrist, he'll save the day in no time.
Okay, but it's the first film I can recall in a long time that has dealt with a certain type of American family that's not fashionable to put on film, and that's a WASP family. And perhaps it's because I'm English that it appealed to me immensely, because what the film really discussed and what was so sensitive about the way Redford directed it and the three main actors in it was that people who live under the tyranny of manners and politeness, the way the English do and the way the WASPs of this country do, often in the same way that Californians gobbling on about their own space, simply don't communicate because they're not allowed to show emotion. And I thought it was an extremely sensitive examination of that.
Short question, how come no one has Humanoids from the Deep on any list? Did you see it? Anyone see it?
See what?
Humanoids from the Deep?
I'll plead guilty. I think it should be pointed out that if you see everything during a year, like 250 films, wherever it is, your perspective of what's good and what's bad is rather informed by, you know, Humanoids from the Deep. You know, your idea of a deep D minus is a lot different from most other people's.
Okay. What are some films that didn't make it on your list, but that you thought had some terrific moments in it, either expanses of great acting or some brilliant direction or maybe really good cinematography, even if the film as a whole didn't meet up to what this specific sequence or moment promised?
Let me cite two very good women's performances. Coal Miner's Daughter, with Sissy Spacek, who I think has probably a lock on the Academy Award next year. A very fine performance of Loretta Lynn in a film which unfortunately sort of came apart in a soap opera in the second half. And nobody's mentioned the film I like very much, Gloria, with Jane Rowlands. I thought it was a very fine performance in a very entertaining film.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, we talked about that during the review, that the performance outweighed the film.
What else did I like? I like Little Miss Marker, the remake of the old classic. I thought it was one of Walter Matthau's best roles in years. And I, too, liked Aeroplane. I also like My Brilliant Career, which is one of the...
The Australian films.
Yeah, the Australian film industry is one of the more interesting things that's going on at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what's some films that you thought there were great moments, but the film itself wasn't as excellent?
Well, I thought Kagemusha was one of those, in fact, where...
It's 3 hours of great moments.
Yeah, the battle scenes were tremendous to look at and didn't hold up. I mean, it was I don't know. It's Kurosawa's, I think, is much better at a smaller screen. I thought Dress to Kill was full of good moments, and I did not include it because I've seen so much De Palma that I liked better. In terms of a lot of films of its genre, I would include it. I mean, you know, formulaic De Palma is good filmmaking, but I had problems with the sexism in it. I wasn't surprised. It was too predictable. Do you see what I mean? But visually, there were some really nice things going on in it. I would like to, can I ask something that has to do with Ordinary People and The Great Santini? Just
okay,
one more
and this
time.
This is in spite of the fact that I promised we'd drop it, but go ahead.
Well, it's not really keeping it. I just wanted to ask these two men their opinion on something. In the reviews I've been doing of this type of film, what I'm bothered by is what I see as a trend to sledgehammer endings where, again, American versus a European film of the same kind, that The Great Santini, for example, would not allow me to make my own judgment on Robert Duvall, that he had to be saving the children in the school and not drunk while flying and, you know, tribute at the graveyard and just this knee-jerk crying going on.
Well, I would agree that that was a mistake in terms of The Great Santini, which had a really super film going to the
I felt that way about Ordinary People as well with Judd Hirsch.
I thought Ordinary People ended up on a kind of open-ended climax. I don't really think anybody was solved. There was a breakup, and people were still left to whatever their future was to work things out. There's the bonding of men, I suppose, is maybe an interesting aspect of Ordinary People. I mean, the bonding of men in a more interesting, more sophisticated way than Westerns or something like that. I would disagree that Ordinary People sort of wrote it out to the last detail. Can we drop the subject and go on to... I think I've said about everything I can think of to say about Ordinary People.
Did you want to react, though, to the idea of the sledgehammer ending, Desmond?
Well,
the sense of going for your emotions
that,
rather than your thoughts.
It is, I suppose, true that Hollywood's distrust of its audience and their sophistication is almost boundless. And I suppose there is a tendency to do that. I didn't find that in Ordinary People. The Great Santini, I think the ending was... they don't trust you to make your own inferences.
Ernie, back to you, and if you want to tell us about some of the films where you
thought
a moment
outshined
the film.
No, I think that's pretty much been covered. I certainly agree about Kagamusha. No, I don't think so.
Okay. We're talking about the films of 1980. If you're just joining us, my guests are Ernie Scheer of The Bulletin, Bill Van Wert, film critic for Fresh Air, and Desmond Ryan of The Enquirer. Tell us about the times when you felt that your review was extremely different than everything else that was in the air, where your opinions were very much out of the mainstream of thought for the time, Ernie?
I don't think this year so much. You mean with other critics?
With other critics, yeah.
No, I think generally throughout the country that the numbers of quality films, everybody seemed to agree generally on which were the 15, 20 or what, you know, films worth seeing, and
okay.
I don't think that was a problem.
Bill?
I think I did that in the introduction of my list with The Long Riders and Wise Blood. That I thought they were far more important than the acclaim they're getting. The funniest film of the year for me was Airplane, and we had a whole show on surrealism in that film and what happened in the background, and I felt that wasn't really covered elsewhere. And I think One Trick Pony and The Shining were very good, and they have gotten very mixed and sometimes very bad acclaim. So,
Desmond?
Well, I don't keep a scorecard through the year. I think a lot of people like the Blues Brothers. I detested it. I don't know how you make a tribute to black music with two white stars. You know, that was wonderful.
Okay. There's been a change in terms of the way we see movies, I think, here in Philadelphia. The Fox is being knocked down. I think we're losing about 3 movie theaters this year. I've had a lot of trouble going to the movies because so many of the screens are so small that it's practically proportionately like watching television. You know, you really have to travel sometimes to get the big screen that movies are supposed to have. What are some of the trends in seeing movies that you can see around here?
Well, you call it television. I call it tunnel vision, that kind of narrow theater where you perceive it like at the end of a telescope. The Eric on Rittenhouse Square, I think, is one of those prime examples of that. It's really uncomfortable and claustrophobic, and it has a bad effect on the acoustics and, your visual sense. In general, I think the trend that movie theaters seem to be going towards that kind of twin theater and a split wall or a median wall, which is so thin that you can hear the movie next door, they're really cutting their own throats, because in years to come, unless a theater can offer a specific visual experience, 70mm Dolby and everything else on a huge screen, people are going to stay home and watch it on a video cassette. One of the unremarked and most significant announcements made this year was by 20th Century Fox, and it sent shivers through the spines of the nation's theater owners, and that was that they would release their movies in video cassette at the same time as they released them to the theater. And they were the first studio to do that, and you can look for the other studios to do so. The technology of video recording is coming down in price. The price of going out to a movie, and I get more mail about that kind of thing, is going up with babysitting, parking, and all the ancillary costs. To make these shoebox theaters is really very dumb on their part.
Any other trends either of you would like to add in screening here in the Delaware Valley?
I think audience manners have deteriorated even further, if that's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you go in, it's really impossible to see a film in Center City,
right.
if you're a serious film goer, except at the Ritz. I find it interesting, instead of running an ad for the concession at the Ritz, they do flash on the screen a request to...
Thank you for not talking. Yeah.
Thank you for not talking. This business, I think that's a people are talking in theaters. I think that's a consequence of television. They're used to seeing films in their own home, where they can get up, walk around, make comment, do whatever they want, and that's spilled over into movie going manners. And then the other detriment to going to films and theaters is that A, the screens are in many theaters postage stamp size, the acoustics are horrible. I don't care what the theater is, there is no theater within a range of 105 miles that has a decent acoustical system, unless it's a special showing and the distributor's contract with the producer calls for beefing up the acoustical system on a temporary basis.
The Fox was good, but they tore it down.
Yeah, because it was a... and theaters are in Center City are filthy. I mean, they are just plain filthy, and you get very surly treatment, even if you keep your mouth shut and are simply trying to buy a ticket, going in and sit down in the theater, you will find that you sometimes, as I have, run across an usher or an assistant manager or a ticket taker who is simply gratuitously rude.
Bill, you mentioned 2 films in the opening of our discussion today that, or maybe 3 films, that haven't made it to Philadelphia. I don't know if they eventually will or not. You mentioned Tess, Mon Oncle d'Amérique, and... Melvin and Howard. Do you feel that most of the films during the past year that you wanted to see eventually came to Philadelphia?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I guess most of them that get national acclaim do. But it really is still controlled on both coasts. And in particular, I think that it's you know, there's an even tighter control on what foreign films get to us. And it really has to do with how quickly they get into distribution after festivals, what kinds of contracts. Some of them get into litigation before they even get here, you know. So a film like the Goalie's Anxiety of the Penalty Kick or Marguerite Duras' film Le Camion aren't playing. They're in litigation in Europe, you know. We're not going to get to see them. So when you find out these kinds of things, you know, you just throw up your hands and it's too bad. Can I add something on the last one?
Since
I didn't get to. Yeah. I think that they're not only filthy theaters in Center City, but they're also sometimes dangerous. I mean, I don't have a problem as a single man walking around at night to see films, but even on a street like Chestnut, it's dangerous down there. And, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, I've had to go to the men's room on occasion in one of those theaters, and it's
I hope you had a police escort.
It's knives out and dope in the bathroom and so on. The alternative, I think, at some of the malls is the bad manners we're talking about, which has a lot to do with a shift in, at least when I was growing up, my parents began taking me to films first, and then I went on my own. But it seems like it's the alternative babysitter, and it's also a babysitter you can talk back to and act rowdy with, so the nicer conditions, let's say out at, I don't know, Plymouth Meeting Mall or Neshaminy or whatever, are countered by kids talking throughout the film and running up and down the aisles. I think the other trend about the city that I would mention is that there's been a decline in the repertories. The ongoing up and down case of TLA, the Walnuts problems with keeping a feature film list going. I think some of the universities now are running film series which are drawing people, like the Cinematheque downtown and series going on at Penn. But people seem to be wanting to, you know, go to see older films. They want to see series of, let's say, Howard Hawks comedies or something. And anyone who's offering that is getting a pretty good turnout.
Don't you think that in itself is kind of comment about contemporary films?
Sure, sure.
Well, is it that, or is it that people are getting very film conscious and wanting to see.
No, I don't agree. I think
see some of the films of the past.
Most popular thing on television, old movies, always has been.
And but I think Philadelphia is not a receptive repertory town. Whether it's a good film town, of course, is another question. The Ritz Three, which is arguably our best theater, both physically and for the kinds of films it runs, exception being the Jazz Singer at the moment. The Ritz 3 had a very long, hard struggle, and the man who owns it, Ray Pozell, had to hang in there for many years before it broke even, largely because of a succession of very popular foreign films, Kazan Kazin and Kajo Fall among them. So that whether there is, in fact, a demand for repertory films in Philadelphia is arguable. It's such a city of neighborhoods. I remember going to see a premiere of the Visconti film, The Innocents, I think it was last year or the year before, at Penn. And there were sort of thousands of people turned away from the Annenberg Theater. But those people don't necessarily go to Second and Walnut to see a film at the Ritz. Or they don't seem to. People who run theaters say that anyway.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the films of 1980, and just speaking was Desmond Ryan. Also with us is Bill Van Wert, film critic for Fresh Air, and Ernie Scheer, film critic for The Bulletin. Do you think that there's any... Well, let's get to some of the controversial film issues of this year. One of the tactics that emerged this year, to mostly in response to two very controversial films, was the idea of boycotting movies. And we saw that twice this year, first with Cruising, which was a film that was boycotted by many people, and then Dressed to Kill, which was a film that many people purposely didn't attend in order to make a consumer statement about the movie. I'd like it if we could just go around the table, if you'd tell us what you thought about both of those films, and also what you think about... boycotting as a way of trying to register the way you feel about a certain kind of movie with the film industry. Bill, you want to take that?
Well, I didn't see Cruising, and it was primarily for the boycott.
You think you shouldn't see a film that's boycotted?
Oh, no, I thought I should have, but instead I got talking with the people on the line. So I did not get to see it and had to go see another one in order to do the review. So I don't know. I mean, I had heard such incredibly bad things from people I trusted that I did not persist with that one. I did see Dress to Kill, and I don't know. I think it's a double answer for people who are that concerned, people who did the boycotting. It sounds like a fine tactic. You know, they don't have any other means to the media or to, you know, publicizing their cause. It's a bother for other people who are going because they want to see the film. I don't think in our positions that we need to be swayed by that. And in fact, I think probably we have a responsibility to cover it and give our own opinion of it.
Desmond, what do you think of both of those films and of the technique of boycotting?
Well, Cruising, in any year that didn't include Caligula, Cruising would easily be the top worst film. You know, I mean, it was really so disgusting that it...
What was disgusting about it?
Well, where to begin? The specifics of the violence, specifics of the sex. Homosexuals felt they were derided both by Cruising and by... Windows, which did the same thing to lesbians and was even worse. Their general contention was that gay life isn't like that, and secondly, that this kind of film would encourage violence against homosexuals. What it encourages is total numbing boredom. It was boycotted, and even though most people would say that a boycott is good publicity for a film, Cruising just dropped dead. It did nothing at all.
Do you think it was because of the boycott or because it was a boring movie?
It was a very poorly assembled movie. It was very incoherent. And its subject was, to say the least, which is those gay leather bars in Manhattan and a murder. It's not a bad novel, actually. It's quite interesting. But what Friedkin did to it in the film is just incredible. The Dress to Kill, I don't share Bill's admiration of. I don't like seeing a woman cut to pieces with a razor, however stylishly it's done. It's probably worse to do it so stylishly as De Palma does that kind of thing. I think it's it really bears thinking about what that does to the minds of these people walking along Chestnut Street that we mentioned.
What's the difference between that and between war movies where we see people blown up by the tens? Dismembered limbs falling off.
I think a war movie is a separate reality. It is a historical thing that you know it's about being at Anzio or something or in Vietnam. It isn't on the streets of a city. And there's endless talk about violence in films, and it's a very complicated subject, obviously. But when you sit in an audience in Center City and you hear the reaction to a murder. You really ought to give you a pause.
What reaction did you hear when Angie Dickinson was murdered? Because it's not. I'm just wondering about this. Did you really?
Cheering.
Yeah.
And whistling. Yeah, he capped her.
Well, this brings up a question.
I think that's a problem, but the comparison is also with a film like Psycho.
Right.
I mean, you know, forever Hitchcock has always been safe and okay, and. You know, we're not talking about violence in Hitchcock, but and that's a classic scene in most textbooks and so on. But
it's also in black and white.
Also, if you look at that shower scene with Annie closeness, it's not violent. It's all
in
your
imagined.
Mind. It's all imagined. No, it's a brilliantly done scene for that very reason.
Sure.
To take a hack version of that would be, say, the first Killing and Cruising, in which a man is tied up on a bed naked and repeatedly knifed. And the knife goes in, the knife goes out, the blood flows. And certainly that's the most distressing aspect of the sort of teenage horror film that's one of the big sort of draws this year, like Prom Night. This is extremely specific in its violence.
Well, I'd just like to pursue something that you said. You talked about the reaction to the murder of the Angie Dickinson character in the film. Some film audiences are so so much into bloodlust. And as a friend of mine once said, in a murder mystery, somebody gets murdered, and that's the basic premise of it. So I'm wondering what you think a filmmaker's responsibility is, given that some audiences share this bloodlust and always seem to cheer when the good guys get killed. How do you think filmmakers should be responding to those audiences? Is it the film's fault, the audience's fault, when really inappropriate reactions, or what we'd probably consider to be inappropriate reactions happen in a movie theater?
If you're quite sure that they're not feeding those reactions, I tend to think of myself as an aesthetic critic and not much for social action on the street. Or I think the best protest, if you feel in advance and you're one of those kind of people that this film is a bad film, should be made, don't buy a ticket, but don't get in my way when I'm on my way into the theater. I think the things that have been interesting in the last year or two is that the women are almost, except for Cruising, which was a special, almost always the victims are women. I think you would have to be blind or be wearing a blindfold not to admit that films have helped to make some contribution to the climate of violence in our society. I think that the thing is not whether a film is violent or whether the women are victims. I think the responsibility of a filmmaker is to make a damn fine film which has some point, to tell us stories. We tend to get so damn esoteric about things that what they are doing are making films solely for effect. And that, to me, is really appalling, this pandering to what they think is a popular taste or a public taste, or trying to make a film in a way that casts a net as wide as possible. You called it bloodlust, but a film that features violence presumably tells us that we live in a violent society. Now that's old news. I mean, your reaction to Ordinary People was that it was old news. I don't think so, because it was new to the screen. But violent films, all you have to do is pick up a newspaper. I mean, we know where we are in this society.
We only have a few minutes remaining in this discussion.
Could I just add something to that?
Yeah.
I think one of the troubles with this kind of discussion is that we tend to have a discussion in a moral and aesthetic context, whereas the decisions by which these films get made are purely commercial, and that's the difference.
Right.
I think also what I have to throw into that is that I would worry much more about the crop of comedies, the Caddyshacks and Gorp and so on, as converging with the zombie films. I mean, there's a lot of just stupid body cruelty being passed off as a joke. And I worry much more about those so-called fun films which aren't funny and seem to require that kind of destruction of 30,000 automobiles or 18 bodies and so on as a dress to kill, there's just not much joy coming out in these films. And
though the tradition stems from animation.
Yeah.
Can you just each tell us briefly what you think some of the trends are going to be in 1981, or some of the films that will be coming out that you're looking forward to, and we don't really have too much time. Ernie?
Well, I hope to see Tess. I hope to see it real soon. Sounds perfectly gorgeous. I have seen Melvin and Howard. I saw it about 3 months ago, and thank God I did write my review at that time. I would hope to see, though it may be a mistake, I would hope to see more, I've always hoped this, more good, medium-sized, quality movies that are well-contained.
Bill?
Well, I'm personally, from my own head, I await films like Mon Oncle d'Amérique, the René films, and so on. And I know that they lose at the box office in this country. I'm anxious to see Ken Russell's Altered States. Trends, I think that there will be more family films of the variety, Ordinary People, Great Santini, much more youth-oriented a la Robbie Benson power or something, and more special effects, you know, more bad imitations of Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, and, you know, that split between story and special effects.
Desmond?
If it's possible to harbor optimism and dread at the same time, that's the way I look at it.
Any specific films you're looking forward to? Or?
I'm looking forward to Altered States. I haven't seen that yet. I've never seen a Ken Russell film I've liked, so this might be a first for me.
Okay. Well, I hope you all have an enjoyable year of film going in 1981, and I want to thank you all for sharing your opinions of the films of 1980. I've been joined by Desmond Ryan, film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Ernie Shear, film critic for the Philadelphia Bulletin, and Bill Van Wert, film critic for Fresh Air. And again, I thank all of you for speaking with us this afternoon. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, all things considered, coming up at 5 o'clock this afternoon. This evening at 10 o'clock, we'll be carrying a one-half-hour summary of this afternoon's, of this morning's confirmation hearing, Senate confirmation hearing for Secretary of State Designate Alexander Haig. So this half-hour summary will be coming up at 10 o'clock. And then following that, at 10:30, we'll be featuring this week's edition of Communique, and the subject will be how liberals in America are planning their strategy for the next 4 years. So again, that's 10 o'clock, a half-hour summary of the confirmation hearings, 10:30, this week's edition of Communique coming up this evening. A reminder that Sunday night at 10 o'clock we'll be featuring the last edition of the Alec Wilder program, Alec Wilder and the American Popular Song, and it's our way of remembering him. Alec Wilder, the composer and author, died late last month of lung cancer. So this Sunday evening between 10 and 11 o'clock you'll be able to hear him along with his co-host and pianist, Lunis McGlowan, and a number of guest singers in that final edition of the Alec Wilder program.